From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Let's begin with a quick thought experiment. Imagine it's night and you're sitting on a beach. Dig your fingers into the sand and feel the grains trickle through your fingers. Now look up and try to guess how many stars are in the universe.
If you estimate how many grains of sand on all the beaches, sand beaches here on planet Earth, it matches roughly the number of stars out there. That just tells you how huge the universe is and how full of opportunities it is.
The question is, out of all those billions and billions of stars and planets, do you really think ours is the only one with life?
Well, you know, to quote Carl Sagan, the famous agnostic, if there isn't life out there, it sure is a big waste of space.
Welcome to the age of astrobiology, the search for life among the stars. New telescopes, new techniques, and a new generation of scientists just may find what we've all been waiting for, news that we're not alone.
We have something we call the extraterrestrial hypothesis. And yes, I definitely do believe that that needs to be seriously considered.
Are we alone in the universe? Almost certainly not. That's an astonishing statement, isn't it? Just a few years ago, it would have been the stuff of science fiction. Now, it's mainstream science. To find out what changed, Anne Strangechamps turned to science writer Mark Kaufman and his new book, First Contact.
Well, your book, Mark, begins with this remarkable opening statement. It's actually so remarkable, I want to quote it. Before the end of this century, and perhaps much sooner than that, scientists will determine that life exists elsewhere in the universe. Really?
Absolutely. And this is the consensus of the people who are involved in this field. What they've found so far points directly to the virtual impossibility of there not being life elsewhere.
Well, so let's go through some of these building blocks that have led to the idea that life exists elsewhere in the universe, the extremophiles.
This is a world of research that kind of began at Yellowstone, where they found at this hydrothermal vent that even though it was super hot, they were finding little microbial life, bacteria, single-cell organisms. And then that got carried further, and they found hydrothermal vents at the bottom of the Pacific Ocean where things were much, much hotter. And still, there were microbes living in temperatures that no one had imagined possible.
And then there have been some found, well, in extremely cold environments too, right?
Absolutely. It turns out, I mean, and again, this is all quite new research, that Antarctica is now being seen as an ecosystem. It's not just frozen ice, but rather in the ice, going down 2-3 miles, there's microbial life in the ice, vast amounts of life.
I sort of have this image of a bunch of microbe hunters who are traveling the world to the most extreme, inhospitable corners of the planet and scraping around trying to find evidence of living bacteria.
It is an absolutely accurate impression. They're doing that in the bowels of the Earth, into the gold mines of South Africa, which are the deepest on Earth. They're finding it in places like Mono Lake, which is very heavy in arsenic. So yes, you're absolutely right. The point in a sense has already been made that life is far, far more tenacious than we ever imagined. But everywhere they look, they find it.
So I have to ask the so what question. I mean, it's marvelous to see how tenacious some of these primitive life forms can be. But what does that prove, really?
It actually proves a lot in two different levels. The first is there has been life on Earth, scientists believe, somewhere around 3.8, 3.9 billion years. Of that time, more than 3 billion years, all they had was microbes. So everything that there is, you know, ragweed and cats and us, it all came from the soup of gradually evolving microbial life. The extrapolation from that is, why wouldn't that happen on Mars? Why wouldn't that be in the seas of Europa underneath the ice crust and so on? So that's the importance of it as seen through astrobiology.
Well, in the meantime, you mentioned that one of the other avenues of astrobiology is this investigation of the makeup of space. What's going on there?
To me, utterly fascinating things. You know, you look up in the sky and you think, well, you know, they're just a bunch of stars and a lot of dark matter, dark energy, and there's not anything in it. Well, it turns out that it is in many different parts of the sky and of the universe. There are complex carbons that are formed and that are just floating around, polyaromatic hydrocarbons, formaldehyde. They even have found amino acids floating in space. And most important, they've found them in meteorites that come from space and have in them both amino acids and something called nucleobases, which are the compounds that are the essential core of RNA and DNA. So all of that is out there in space.
Wow, that makes me think that when you look out into the night sky, what we're seeing, or what we'd see if we had giant telescopes, is a universe that's just seeded with life, or the building blocks of life. And those seeds then, like dandelion fluff, drift down onto a planet, and if the conditions are right, they can take root and produce life.
And that's absolutely correct, which is why one of the main reasons why astrobiologists believe that it is almost impossible that there isn't life elsewhere, because there are all those planets and there's all that material and it's all falling down. And that's happening on every planet and every moon in the universe.
Mark, you started by saying that most astrobiologists, and you yourself also, firmly believe that there is life elsewhere in the universe. I guess I want to ask about whether that's changed you personally. I mean, when you look out at the night sky now, do you feel any different?
Actually, I do, yes. It's just kind of filled me increasingly with an awe and just a wonder of what's out there. The amount of knowledge that scientists have put together is extraordinary and impressive. And what it says is that the universe has in it a logic that seems to drive towards there being life, toward biology, and it's hard to not be deeply moved by the very strong likelihood that there is life in different forms of evolution all around.
Mark Kaufman, talking with Ann Strangechamps. He is a science writer and national editor for The Washington Post, and the author of First Contact, Scientific Breakthroughs in the Hunt for Life Beyond Earth. It's one thing to imagine a universe seeded with microscopic forms of life. But what about E.T.? Extraterrestrial spaceships, visitors from other planets. It's not the stuff of science, of course, but maybe it could be. Journalist Leslie Kane is the author of UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. Now, most UFO sightings turn out to have perfectly natural explanations. But not all. Leslie Kane got interested when she stumbled on an official government report that she just couldn't ignore.
A colleague from France sent me an extraordinary report on the UFO subject that had been translated into English and was written by a group of generals, an admiral, the former head of the Space Study Center, the National Space Study Center in France, which was the equivalent to our NASA here, and a group of scientists, very high-level people, and they'd taken a look at some of the most important UFO cases, only dealing with official data. And in looking at the cases for which there was enough evidence that they could rule out any kind of conventional explanation, this group of very distinguished people came to the conclusion that the best, most logical, most rational, and most likely explanation for this group of cases was what they called the extraterrestrial hypothesis. And again, there aren't that many UFO sightings that we have enough data for to make that kind of an assumption, but they found that conclusion. And I, as a journalist, thought this was absolutely fascinating that high-level people are actually saying that there's a very good chance that we are being visited by extraterrestrial craft.
That really is astonishing when you think about it from America's perspective. That is not an attitude that is taken here at all.
Exactly. And the thing that ran through my mind was just what you said. I thought, what if four American generals and an American admiral and the former head of NASA had come out and made that statement? What would the reaction be in America? It would be a huge story, front page news. So here it was happening in France. And so that's why, as a journalist, I got very intrigued with that as a story initially. And I did a piece for the Boston Globe based on that French report. And ever since then, I've been digging into it and been absolutely fascinated by this very genuine mystery that we still have not solved.
As you've stuck with this story, you've done a fair amount of research and you've found some fascinating things. One of the eyewitness reports, an official investigation, I guess, was from a Belgian major general, Wilfried de Brouwer.
It began in the fall of 1989 in November with a couple of triangular objects that were kind of cruising over parts of Belgium, witnessed by hundreds of people, including 13 policemen from different locations. It was just sort of this massive sighting. And the interesting thing about that was that these objects kept returning to Belgium for about a year and a half. These very large, triangular, silent objects with three bright spotlights on each corner and a red light in the middle. That was sort of the standard way people described them, that could take off at the blink of an eye without making a sound and could kind of drift almost like a boat on the water, kind of drift over very slowly. Major de Brouwer was actually a colonel at the time, and he was given the job by the Ministry of Defense in Belgium to investigate this, to try to figure out who these visitors were, because they were committing infractions of airspace rules. Nobody knew what these objects were, what they represented, why they were there. And so he was in charge of this, the whole Air Force investigation. He worked closely with a group of scientists who conducted lots of interviews and kept massive amounts of records of all the reports that they got. He sent up F-16s to try to get closer looks at the object, to learn more about them. And they never were able to solve the question of what these objects were.
Well, there must have been a lot of suggestions at the time. One can imagine that the suggestion would be that they were radar invisible aircraft from some other country, for instance, or that they were some other kind of natural phenomenon. Each of those must have been considered and rejected by General de Brouwer?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, I think the leading argument was that this was some kind of an advanced U.S. or possibly Russian, you know, spy plane, that it was some kind of a stealth aircraft that was being tested, exotic technology from another country. I just don't think anybody thought it was a natural phenomenon. It was just seen too many times. It was clearly this thing with these lights on it. But what General de Brouwer did was he went to high levels of his colleagues within the United States government, and he went to other governments within the NATO alliance and asked, is this one of yours?
Of course, would they tell him the truth?
Well, he believes that they would, and other people have told me that they would. I mean, he was a colonel. And you have this very strange thing happening. And the thing is that NATO countries don't go sending strange technology over their partners without telling them about it. I mean, it just doesn't happen. That's what I've been told. General de Brouwer certainly believes that they would tell him the truth.
There are a number of other stories that you go into over the course of the book. Pilots, I gather, are more likely than anyone else to see UFOs and to report UFOs, which I imagine makes sense. They spend more time in the sky than anybody else.
They are probably one of the more likely people to see them. They are not the more likely people to report them, though, however, because the problem we have is that pilots are very nervous about reporting sightings. And in fact, they are discouraged from doing so by the FAA, which is really a problem. The FAA actually says in its manual for its employees that if a pilot, a crew member, sees anything anomalous, sees a UFO, they are not to report it to the FAA, but they are to take it to a civilian research group. And they say, even if this is a life-threatening situation, you can report it to the police, but you can't report it to the FAA, which is the body responsible for air safety in this country.
How do they explain that?
They really don't. It's a good question.
I suppose the easy answer that leaps to mind is that the FAA is afraid of ridicule.
Exactly. And the pilots are, too. The pilots are afraid of ridicule. I mean, that's why they don't report a lot of their sightings. And we know this because there is a former NASA scientist by the name of Dr. Richard Haynes, who has spent decades interviewing pilots. He's an aviation expert on these cases, and he has files of cases. And the pilots have talked to him, but they have not filed any kind of official reports on these sightings with the FAA for the reasons I just mentioned. Yeah. So there are a lot more pilots that see them than there are pilots who report them. And sometimes aviation people will report them to a civilian group just because they feel it's so important, especially when the situation involves safety issues. They just feel, well, this has got to be dealt with, so they have no choice. They go to a civilian group, and then the word gets out. It's a very strange situation, and this is not how it's handled in Europe.
Well, that's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because it is more likely to be reported elsewhere. In fact, you've got a couple of reports from military pilots who met for the first time when you were present and related what sound like remarkably similar stories.
Those were both Air Force pilot situations as opposed to commercial pilots. They both involve cases in which the pilots felt a need to fire, to actually aim missiles and try to shoot down a UFO. One of them was from Peru and one was from Iran.
Just to kind of summarize them, they both involved sightings and both involved fear of being attacked, and they responded by wanting to defend themselves.
Yeah, that was more the case for the Iranian event, which took place in 1976. The pilot in that case, there were four pilots involved that were sent up by the general on the ground to just observe what this brilliant light was that was sitting up there over Tehran, being witnessed by lots of people on the ground. And this pilot in this one aircraft, there was this very, very brilliant triangular-shaped object. And from that object, these smaller, what he called projectiles, these round things came, were sort of shot out towards his aircraft. He felt compelled to defend himself, prepared his firing system to fire heat-seeking missiles at these things. So he had it locked on so that the missile knew where to go, was just about to press the trigger to fire this thing, and he lost control of his equipment. And this happened three different times. He was just about to press the button and fire, and he would lose control of the equipment. That's something he could not explain, but that's what happened. And this case was written up in detail by the United States government, by the way, in a three-page Defense Intelligence Agency document, which is absolutely fascinating.
So I have to ask you then, do you believe that UFOs are evidence of extraterrestrial visitation?
Well, I certainly am open to that possibility. You know, I align myself with many high-level people who have themselves stated that they can't imagine what else these things could be. Mm. So we have something we call the extraterrestrial hypothesis. And yes, I definitely do believe that that needs to be seriously considered. I think it's a very likely possibility, even though I know it's very difficult to accept it, given the questions that physicists will raise about, you know, travel through space and all the issues that come along with considering this. And why haven't we already discovered it, if it's real, if they're really visitors? You know, there's lots of questions that come up, which are legitimate questions. Nonetheless, we're sort of stuck with the data that we have. There's nothing we can do about what we know. And it's very hard to come up with other explanations, but there's other explanations such as things like visitors from other dimensions or something. Yeah. You know, if you look at some of the cutting-edge physics, the work of Brian Greene or Michio Kaku, you know, these could be some kind of visitors from the future, from other dimensions, or from other planets. We just really don't know. But I think we have to stay very open to the possibility that they could be extraterrestrial. And that word, I guess, could have a lot of different meanings. I don't understand why everybody wouldn't want to know what these things are. I think it's just the most fascinating mystery that we're faced with right now, one of the most fascinating anyway.
Leslie Kane is the author of UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. Coming up, a Vatican astronomer explains why the Catholic Church is interested in extraterrestrial life. And science fiction writer Orson Scott Card lays out some first contact scenarios. I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. William Blake famously advised learning to see a world in a grain of sand. That could be the motto for astrobiology, which brings together the science of some of the tiniest things on Earth, microbes, with the study of some of the largest structures in the universe, stars. Astronomer Dimitar Sasilov is one of the pioneers of the field. He's the founder and director of the Harvard Origins of Life Initiative and the author of The Life of Super-Earths. Anne Strainchamps wondered,
do you ever lie in bed at night and try to imagine what it would be like to see one of those planets?
I do. I know that it's very difficult for this dream to become reality, to see them the same way we see pictures from Mars or Mercury. I particularly like lying in the backyard in the summer at night and looking at the stars. There, I can almost see them.
Would they be beautiful?
What might be beautiful is the unexpected. The beauty that you experience when you first go to, say, the Bryce Canyon or to Yellowstone. And you've seen all those pictures and you've heard the stories. But when you see them for yourself, you always discover that there is some set of colors or some shadow that you never imagined. I think our exploration of exoplanets is a similar voyage where, despite all our expectations, we end up being surprised. It's hugely exciting.
So there are kind of two parts. One is the hunt for these exoplanets or the hunt for other planets that might be habitable. And the other is the look inside test tubes, the hunt for new forms, new kinds of life.
Yes, there is a real connection between what we do in our labs, trying to understand life and its basic functions, and discovering those other environments out there, which appear to be similar to our Earth-like environments, but in many ways different. And so the question there, if the environments are different and life emerged there, would it be based on a different chemistry?
What's happening in the lab?
What is happening in the lab is extremely exciting. It is the ability to synthesize the individual molecules of life and to succeed in engaging them in performing the chemical networks that we associated with life.
I mean, they
grow.
So
in a sense, they grow, they replicate, they use energy in different ways. These are systems which are self-adapting, they're self-sustaining, they're organic, they're, you can call them soft machines in a certain sense. We are now understanding how to build those systems which essentially mimic the functions of life. We can literally build one or try to build one and understand first the nature of our own biochemistry and second, how we could possibly build another one.
Has anybody actually done this yet?
What people have done is that they've tried to achieve that. It's called the artificial minimal cell. The artificial minimal cell could be built in two different ways. One is top-down. That is, you take the simplest, smallest microbe with the simplest genome, and you try to pare it down even further to come to the really basics of a function and the smallest possible minimal. That's why it's called minimal cell. This top-down approach has been attempted now for almost 40 years. People have been working very hard on it. And there was a big breakthrough about 2-3 years ago by the Venter Institute. There is the other avenue to create a minimal cell, which is bottom-up. That is to build all the necessary molecules synthetically in the lab and then put them together. That was had a huge obstacle for the past 40 years because nobody knew how to build synthetically a key component, which is called a ribosome, or the ribosomes which all cells in all living creatures have. Mm-hmm. They're the ones which actually translate what's on the DNA into actual proteins. And
can't replicate without molecules. It.
And this was achieved by the George Church Lab in our bigger team here about a year ago. So that opens up now the possibility to bring this bottoms-up approach all the way to creating a minimal cell, and that's what I discuss in my book.
So I want to ask you the same question I asked you about the planets. Where do you find the beauty in it?
I think life in itself is a beautiful phenomenon. I look at it from the perspective of being an astronomer, from the perspective of the stars, if you will. And then you look at it as a phenomenon, as a planet which is living, a living planet. It is so amazing to see the diversity of life here on our own planet Earth in just 4 billion years of opportunity to do so. Life has explored all the possibilities on the planet, even not mentioning technological civilization and Homo sapiens. Just the diversity in the microbial and plant and animal life is so amazing that projecting this then on the scale of the galaxy and the rest of the universe is probably beyond our imagination at this point. But it's fascinating anyway.
Yeah, and especially when you say, look what life has done, how it's proliferated and how many, you know, myriad forms it's taken on this planet. And that's just carbon-based life. So then if you begin to imagine that there could be many other alternative chemistries of life, wow, it's kind of dizzying. Getting a sort of visceral sense of the abundance across is always really hard. I love that you use this one analogy of grains of sand on a beach.
Yes, this is a beautiful analogy. And I have to give credit here to Jeffrey Bennett, who came up with the back of the envelope calculation, as we say in science. It is surprisingly true. If you estimate how many grains of sand there on all the beaches, sand beaches here on planet Earth, it matches roughly the number of stars out there. And that just tells you how huge the universe is and how full of opportunities it is as well.
Yeah, I read that and I tried to slow down and think, okay, imagine I'm on a beach and I've dipped my hand into the sand and, you know, I can feel the grains trickle through my fingers. And then I look across the beach and I see all that sand and think of all those grains. And then I look down the coastline and I see all the beaches. And then I pull way back and imagine all the beaches on Earth and all those grains of sand. And that's how many stars are in the universe. But then the point of the new discoveries we've been talking about is that that's just the stars. There are billions more planets than there are stars, right?
We believe so, yes. The number of planets at least matches the number of stars at current estimate. And it may turn out that it even exceeds it.
So what will change for us, do you think, in a felt sense, the day the headline appears that says that we found life on another planet?
Well, I've thought about this a little bit, and it is a historic shift in the frame of reference. But, you know, whenever this occurred in the past, it took people time to absorb it. I think it takes a generation. The new generation, which is born into the new frame of reference, simply accepts it as the normal way of life. And that's when they look back and say, aha, this is the year, this is the time when that watershed moment occurred.
Do you think it'll be a good change? I mean, do you think we'll become, I don't know, kinder, better people as a result?
Yes, I actually am convinced that it will be a good change. Partly because I look back in history, and every time we understood something deep about the world around us, eventually it led to things which benefited us, both our souls and our material being. It reminds me of the Copernican Revolution, which was meant to be a very esoteric, mathematical, astronomical change in the frame of reference, but resulted in the Industrial Revolution, in technology and in everything that we know today, and which makes our lives better. It makes us better eventually.
Yeah, I was trying to think how I would feel if I knew there was life elsewhere in the universe. And I just had a quick kind of glimpse of it, but it made me feel that the world, the universe, is a friendlier place than I thought. It did make me feel less alone. Sounds corny, I guess, but I don't know, that's how I felt.
That's exactly what I meant. This is exactly the kind of feeling that I would get myself, and that's why I think that this will be a positive change for all of us, for humankind.
Dimitar Sasolov teaches astronomy at Harvard and is the founder and director of the Harvard Origins of Life Initiative. His new book is called The Life of Super Earths. Anne Strenchamp spoke with him. When Guy Consolmagno was a freshman in college, he thought about becoming a Jesuit priest. Science lured him away. He went to MIT, got a doctorate in planetary science, and then realized something was missing. Today, Guy Consolmagno is Brother Guy, a Jesuit priest and an astronomer at the Vatican. He believes science and religion can work alongside each other.
Anybody who's looked at the stars and not been moved just emotionally has no soul. That's something that is wonderful about astronomy, that anyone at any level of education can go out and just go, wow. And if you look through a telescope and you see the rings of Saturn, that's even more wow. And if you're able to handle the mathematics to understand all of the things that you can get to when you get to graduate school, then that's just all the more amazing and wonderful. You know, it's one thing to be amazed that the universe is rational and makes sense. That was completely unexpected. But that it should also be beautiful is the deepest and most wonderful mystery.
Do you see astronomy as a spiritual pursuit?
I'll say how my religion and science interact is it's not the case that I'm going to use my science to prove or disprove some religious point. That doesn't work. But they both interact on a meta level. Religion is what motivates me to do science. Religion is what gives me the courage to say there are going to be answers. The universe is rational.
So one of the big things going on right now that I suspect is talked about a lot in all of the fields in which you work is the search for life, that there may be life, that there is the expectation of life elsewhere in the universe, biological life, maybe intelligent life, maybe life that we can communicate with. Do you imagine that is a possibility? Is it a possibility you would welcome?
Yes and yes. Absolutely. Part of that is the science fiction fan in me. You know, I'll confess one of the reasons I went to MIT was to read science fiction. They have a big science fiction library there. Part of it is scientific. You know, my master's thesis at MIT, among other things, predicted oceans under the ice crust of Europa and even talks about the possibility of life there. That was 1975. So I would feel vindicated if we actually found life in those places. Part of it is simply, well, you know, to quote Carl Sagan, the famous agnostic, if there isn't life out there, it sure is a big waste of space.
So tell me, does the Vatican have a position on how to respond to the possibility of life outside of Earth?
Vatican doesn't have positions like that on anything. But there's certainly no reason to argue theologically one way or the other.
Well, I can imagine that there might be some who would say, again, and perhaps I'm just, and perhaps I'm misquoting, I don't know, God gave his only son God created man in his own image, those kinds of things. If those are true, how is it possible for there to be life elsewhere?
Well, you know, I'll give you 3 points. First, the whole idea of what is God's image and likeness. That was discussed in the Middle Ages, and what we were talking about in the terms of the Middle Ages was soul, what Thomas Aquinas refers to as intellect and free will. In other words, an entity that is aware of itself, aware of other entities, and able to make choices, maybe to love or not love, to interact or not interact. That's the essence of what the image and likeness of God is about. It has nothing to do with how many tentacles you have. The other question of God sending his son, our theology also says that this person of the Trinity was there at the beginning, long before the earth was created, and thus not tied merely to planet Earth. We also have in our religious tradition the tradition of, if nothing else, we've got angels who are presumably intelligent beings, free to choose or not choose, creations of the Creator, and obviously not human beings. We're not afraid of there being other entities out there.
Does this suggest that there could be a seven-tentacled Jesus landing on the third moon of Saturn?
For all I know, when you find them, ask me again. We don't know how it's going to work. You know, it's one of our fellows at the observatory said the incarnation of Jesus is, in a sense, the Word. You know, that's how it's described in John's Gospel. Who's to say that word couldn't exist in more than one language? On the other hand, the fact that it happened once with us human beings here on Earth is sufficient to say that it's possible that it did happen, like a mathematical proof. It's the one instance that says, okay, it could happen. And once is sufficient. But whether a zillion, we don't know.
Of course, for centuries, the Catholic Church's response to the discovery of new lands, of new people, was to send out missionaries to convert everyone. Do you suppose that could happen again? It's been the subject of that science fiction that you so love.
Right. Well, the very fact that they sent out the missionaries showed that they accepted these other people as fully equal human beings.
And if the discovery of life turns out to be lettuce plants in the galaxy next door, it's going to be a little difficult.
Well, the fact of the matter is that the possibility of finding intelligent life in our own solar system is probably limited.
And yet it
but
is something
having, that... Having said that, oh yeah, I agree. It's something that is fantastic to think about, precisely in the sense of science fiction. In saying, all right, let's posit this way, then what happens? Because when you ask, you know, what does the image and likeness of God mean? What is it like to talk to a non-human entity? You're immediately asking, well, then what does it mean to be human? What does it mean for us to have a soul? What does it mean for us to have a savior? Is it likely that other intelligent beings who are going to be subject to presumably the same laws of physics and chemistry, you know, they're going to have to eat food and if they fall off a cliff, they're going to kill themselves. Are they also going to have the same laws of right and wrong? Are they going to say that lying is a sin, that taking their life, an intelligent life, is a sin, that the possibility of sin exists? These are great questions. These are science fiction questions, and these are philosophy questions for which there is never going to be a final, definitive answer. But always, the more you think about them, the more you talk about them, the more you play with the ideas, the more you can come back and reflect on what it really means to yourself.
One of the other things, not science fiction, that is currently talked about a great deal in the world of cosmology is the theory of the multiverse, the potentially infinite number of universes, and we're living in just one. What do you think of that?
Well, we've got people working at the Vatican Observatory who are actually looking into the mathematics of this, the physics of this. One of our cosmologists did his doctorate under Martin Rees, who is one of the people who's come up with the idea. I think it's a great idea, both to make you think and to make you appreciate the infinite possibilities of creation. You know, back when Genesis was being written and whoever wrote it took the best science of that day, which was Babylonian science, and said, bigger than the flat world that we all know we live on and the dome and the water above and below the dome, bigger than any of that was God. And that was as big as they could imagine. If we say bigger than this solar system, bigger than this galaxy, bigger than our universe, bigger than all of the infinite multiverses together is God, then we're really talking some big.
It does seem to present a challenge, but you're saying it's a challenge really not to religion but to the imagination.
It is. A religion that doesn't challenge you is not much of a religion. And frankly, a science that doesn't challenge you is not much of a science.
Stephen Hawking, in his recent book, said, we no longer need philosophy. The implication was pretty clear that he felt we no longer need religion because science can explain everything. Do you feel you've answered that?
Well, when Hawking says we don't need God to start the universe, he's right. Anyone who's trying to use God to explain the things that science can't explain in the 21st century is a fool, because who knows what the science is going to explain in the 23rd century. That's called the God of the gaps, and in fact, it's the fastest route to atheism, because if your belief in God is the God who can explain why something happens, and then science comes along with an explanation, oops, suddenly I don't believe in that God anymore. Hawking is right that you don't need God to explain the gaps in our knowledge. But of course, he doesn't really mean we don't need philosophy. The very statement, we don't need philosophy, is a philosophical statement. And there's an awful lot of value, a lot of value that I got as a Jesuit, in studying philosophy, in studying history, in studying the humanities. Sadly, an awful lot of British scientists of the older generation never got around to taking Philosophy 101.
Brother Guy Consolmagno is an American research astronomer and planetary scientist at the Vatican Observatory. Have you ever imagined the day the headlines read, "We are not alone"? Writer Orson Scott Card has invented dozens of first contact scenarios. We'll talk with him in a minute. And because we can never fit everything we want to into just 1 hour of radio, there's more on our website. More interviews, longer interviews, transcripts of interviews, lists of books and music, and links to blogs. You'll find it all at ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Here's where I get stuck. I can imagine that scientists will find life somewhere out there in the universe. What I can't imagine is what'll happen next. Thank goodness for science fiction writers. Let's turn to Orson Scott Card, one of the best-known science fiction writers alive. His classic novel Ender's Game appears on every top 10 list and is a classroom staple in high schools and colleges. This weekend, Ender's Game opens in movie theaters around the country. Steve Paulson reached Orson Scott Card at his home in North Carolina and asked him about first contact scenarios.
I want to take you back to the very first book, Ender's Game, because one of the big questions is how we on Earth would respond to the news that we've made contact with an alien species. Why did this idea interest you?
It only interested me really because it's happened time and time again in human history. We are constantly running into people that seem strange to us, people who speak different languages, people who look different, have different racial characteristics, have different customs, don't subscribe to our worldview, don't share our religion. These contacts have almost always resulted in quite awful things happening. The constant is that we are frightened of what is different and new, and yet we're attracted by it, we're drawn to it.
And it seems to me that the stakes get raised quite a bit if we don't actually understand this other alien species. I mean, let's just sort of speculate how this might work. I mean, let's suppose, as in your books, there is this entirely different kind of intelligence, what you describe as the formix, as sort of this ant-like species, super intelligent with a hive mind. We don't know how to communicate with them, and so we don't know.
Yeah, they've never developed a language, but I was consciously working with the fact that when Columbus first came to the Americas, he brought with him interpreters who could speak or make themselves known in every language that he could think of. And so he wrote in his log, "The natives here have no language." Well, that is literally true in the case of the Formix. They have no language. They have no need of it. They communicate in a way that is beyond, above, behind, below language, so that words never became necessary. Their memory is excellent, and they share memories. They have memory dump. Capabilities between individuals. And so there was never a need for any language to evolve.
And of course, what happens in Ender's Game, there's war at first contact, and the aliens attack Earth without realizing that the humans are a sentient species because we're so different, we do not have the hive mind.
Yeah, they were at least as bigoted as we were in this story because they assumed that any sentient being they met would be like them, that is, with a central queen who was the mind of the group and a bunch of expendable workers. And so they signaled their intentions by killing a few workers. It's not a big deal. No reason to fight a war. And so they think they are trying to communicate, but the result is humans are dying and we've got to put a stop to it. And we do. There's no doubt in Ender's Game or Ender's Shadow that humans have a right to defend themselves and certainly have a reason to defend themselves. The tragedy is that we think the enemy's purpose is malevolent Whereas once they fail to establish this colony, they really intend to leave us alone. They have no interest in running up against us anymore, but we don't know that and have no way of knowing that. They attacked us once, we assume they're going to attack again, and as any good military thinker knows, what do you do with an enemy like that? You take preemptive action.
Well, let me make this a little more personal for you. Suppose there was news that an alien species, a highly intelligent species, was moving around our solar system with the capability of coming to Earth. Would you be scared?
That news has been circulating since the first UFO sightings. I just don't believe it. So what you're really saying is it has to be credible news. It has to be news coming from
right.
a credible source.
Credible news, yes.
So in that case, you know, I'd be among the last to hear, naturally. I have no inside line. And so it would be covered by the news. Now, what way would it be framed? How would that contact have been made? If the news is, this is so exciting, they're talking to us, they're coming to Earth to visit, that suggests one kind of communication. But if the news is, several humans have been killed, a ship has been exploded, you know, our satellites are being swallowed up, that's a different kind of news. It's never going to come as just, whoa, aliens have been found. We're going to be told the nature of the contact, and we're going to make assumptions based on the nature of the contact. But let's say the communication is excellent, and these aliens are going to be visiting Earth. They come from Earth-like planets, or they don't. If they don't, we're pretty safe, because we've got nothing they want. They're going to want to find a world that's like theirs, and they're not going to be able to make much use of worlds that aren't. But if they're like us, if they can breathe our atmosphere, if they use the same kind of life principles that we use, then I would not be so much scared as suspicious.
Now, of course, there's another dimension to any kind of first contact, and that's not just how would we respond to the aliens. I mean, you know, would we go to war? Would we try to, you know, negotiate with them? Whatever. There's also, what would we do among ourselves? The way this plays out in your Ender's books, there is massive political realignment. There's a common enemy out there, and warring parties on Earth have to somehow come together to deal with this threat.
Well, when the aliens show up and their first action is to start terraforming Earth, that is, remaking it, wiping out our biosphere, killing every human that they find, that sort of focuses one's attention. That's just history talking. Mm-hmm. But if they come in a way that is not hostile, not obviously murderous on its face, then we start competing for their attention. If it seems like they might be bringing benefits, then aren't we going to be furious if they go first to London or first to Beijing and not to New York or Washington? History is the great teacher. If you want to see what human beings would do when aliens showed up, see what China did when the Spanish showed up with silver to trade, or see what the American Indians did when the Spaniards showed up, or see what Africans did when Europeans came offering money for slaves.
Most of those examples that you just gave, I mean, the history is not pretty there, especially for the natives.
Well, not always especially for the natives. You know, when Europeans showed up in Africa, the Europeans died like flies because we did not have immunity to the diseases that were endemic in Africa. We were sitting ducks, kept Africa safe for a long time. The reverse was true when we came to the Americas. We had diseases that they were not able to cope with. And so most of the time, Europeans were moving into a decimated population.
Now, there's also a science question at the heart of this kind of story of contact with an alien civilization, and that is whether some other kind of civilization would be very different than we are, as is the premise in your book. Do you accept that basic premise?
Well, we only have one example of high intelligence that has done what humans have done, which is we have moved our evolution off the gene and into the meme. So that genes are now nearly irrelevant to human evolution. We now are able to allow human beings who have bad teeth or who have genetic defects or who are susceptible to various diseases, we now are able to survive because we are able to pool our knowledge, pass it from generation to generation, from culture to culture, from tribe to tribe, from nation to nation, so that human progress is able to spread throughout the species independent of genetic survival. So we have to assume that that's the only kind of alien we're likely to have come to us because they will have a technology that requires that. We'll have common ground.
Of course, another thing that might happen is they might be us. You know, we might be going out and colonizing a galaxy. Do you think that's in our future? Does it have to be in our future if the human species is going to survive?
I think it would be highly desirable. You know, right now, we're still completely vulnerable to the random asteroid strike, to another star or heavy object passing near our solar system. We have no guarantee that the asteroid that will wipe out all life on Earth is not 10 years away from us right now on a collision course with us that we simply cannot evade. It's, you know, curtains. The only defense against that is to have dispersed. And so while that sounds really improbable, while Newt Gingrich is kind of ridiculed for saying, we're going to put a base on the moon, the truth is somebody somewhere really should have the vision to prepare to defend Earth against the asteroid strikes that are avoidable and to disperse the human race to other habitable worlds where we can become self-sustaining populations so that an asteroid strike doesn't wipe us out.
Of course, there would be all kinds of moral and ethical issues that would come up if we start colonizing not only the rest of the solar system, but beyond.
Well, absolutely. I mean, if you go to another world, either it has life or it doesn't. If it doesn't, then it's not going to have an oxygen atmosphere. Our oxygen atmosphere is the result of life on Earth, not the cause of it. Life evolved in a methane atmosphere and changed it. The oxygen we breathe is the product of life. And so what we're going to find is that if there's no life, then it's going to take a long time when we introduce life to make it habitable by human beings. If there already is life, the only way to make it life that we can use is to come in and basically short-circuit the development of that life into what it was going to naturally evolve to and take over the world. Now, personally, I have no problem with this. We're life. That's one of the things that happens. If we're not wiping out a sentient species, my answer is, yeah, we do have a right to defend ourselves against future asteroid strikes or other astronomical disasters by establishing ourselves on other worlds.
Orson Scott Card is the author of the science fiction classic Ender's Game. The book's just been made into a movie, which opens this week. Steve Paulson reached him at his home in North Carolina. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream or download To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you'll also find a link to the weekly podcast, along with 10 years or so worth of interviews available to download and share. If you want a CD copy of this hour, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for Alone in the Universe. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio, and Strange Champs produced this hour with help from Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, and Charles Monroe Kane and Brittany True. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson.
PRI, Public Radio International.